my pleasure to reintroduce Cynthia Molavita from Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary and for her third of three seminars. Thank you, Cynthia.
I am so, as I said last time, I'm just so grateful to be here doing this work with you. I would love to know at the outset how many people were not here for either the first or the second session. Oh, wow. Okay. Very good. That's helpful to know, I'm thinking. As Sharon said, this is the third in a three-part series looking at what it means to heed God's call to love neighbor as self in the age of climate catastrophe. And by way of...
Hey, Cynthia. I think your microphone's on.
Oh, yes. You're so right. I really...
Now is it on? Yes. Thank you. I really am not a high-tech person, including even a microphone. So, here we go. You notice my elaborate PowerPoint. My kids are up there, and they can tell you stories about my vast acumen with technology. By way of getting newcomers in the room up to speed, let's look back a little bit, just briefly, on the last 2 days, where we've been. We, you and I, live at a time, at a perhaps the pivotal point in human history. One climate expert says this may be the most important, the next very few years, 5 to 7, may be the most important in human history. And that is because we will determine whether we go forward in this kind of torrential race toward the worst of climate catastrophe, or whether we put the brakes on, lower, as a human civilization, lower our emissions dramatically, which will mean change in all aspects of how we live. That is a decision that rests in human hands at this point. That has not been the primary concern of these sessions. The primary concern has been a related point of, to me, haunting implications. And that is that climate change is being suffered first and foremost not by the people causing it. Climate change is caused by the high-consuming societies and sectors, and it is being the ravages of climate-related storms and drought and flooding are being suffered by predominantly impoverished people who are predominantly, not singularly of course, people of color. That is, especially in the continents of Africa and Asia and parts of the Caribbean and Latin America, and the impoverished communities in the U.S. So what on earth does it mean for us who are the high consuming, per capita, per person, we are amongst the highest emitters of greenhouse gases of people on earth. What does it mean for us to claim to love the neighbors that are dying as a result of climate change's ravages? We noted yesterday a confounding paradox, and that is we can't deal with climate change until without recognizing that it's going on and recognizing that the breadth of it, the magnitude of it, the systems involved in it. But the more we know, the more powerless or hopeless or filled with despair we can become. And I asked yesterday, and I would ask again now, how many people have experienced that paradox? How many have experienced, let me ask you, how many have experienced this gnawing sense of hopelessness related to climate change? Interesting, yeah. I'm not surprised. So the question before us becomes a vital one. And that is, What are the keys to facing, to telling the truth about climate change? What are the keys to moving forward? So that is getting to know what's happening. And I became, this hit me with overwhelming force when I was in India some years ago. I had been asked to come and work on eco-justice matters with seminaries that were requiring, many, 40 seminaries requiring eco-justice curriculum in the seminary. This is years ago. And it was there that they taught me about the current, at that point, 25 million climate refugees and what was happening to them. What are the keys to knowing those truths, truth-telling about climate injustice, while also sustaining and building hope and a sense of moral, spiritual power? That is the power to move from the way things are toward the way things ought be. That's a question before us all. How do we learn to tell the truth and have hope and moral power? So yesterday we talked about one of those keys being forming a kind of framework for the various elements of change that are needed so that we can understand where each person and each community fits into that framework. And we named a lot of things that I won't go back to. Today, I'd like to move on with another question. And that is the question of, where do we find the moral and spiritual wherewithal to face the truth and not run away? Where do we find the vision and the courage to repent of lives that cause climate change and move forward in a very, very different direction? Where do we drink hope? How many of you identify in one way or another with Christian traditions? And how many with Lutheran Christian traditions? How many with other religious traditions? And how many find your main sources of moral and spiritual wisdom, you know, outside of religion but in other wisdom traditions? Okay, good. Today, we will talk mostly about Christian, I am convinced that religion, including Christianity, does hold profound seeds of hope and moral power. Today, we will be talking largely about Christianity. And let me make three important clarifications. I am not asking us to probe Christianity because it's better than other religious traditions. I'm asking us to probe Christianity because it's where I am located, and it's where many, many, many of you are located, and people must probe traditions in which they are located for the power that those traditions can offer. I also am not suggesting that religion is the only source of moral and spiritual wherewithal. I don't believe that at all. I fully believe that religion must be in deep dialogue with other sources of human knowledge, fields of inquiry, including the natural sciences, the social sciences, the fine arts, medicine and law and education and every field of human inquiry. So I'm not holding up religion as singular. I'm saying that if people within a religious tradition don't say to it, feed me for this, and do not plumb its depths, then that particular body of wisdom goes unused. It's as if science didn't plumb its depths for what to do related to climate change, then science would go unused. So that clarification is important. Let me see if there's another one. Oh yeah, another. I am convinced that one cannot be situated in a religious tradition without being critical of it. Critical of where it has betrayed the incredible truths that it is intending to communicate. Are you with me on that? Mm-hmm. So if we had more time, we'd spend a lot of time looking at how Christianity has fueled the ecological crisis. And we could, I would ask you all to name Christian beliefs and practices that have helped us to think that we are to dominate and just to use the earth, et cetera. But we have an hour, so we're not going to go there now. That said, let me ask you for a moment to think where within your religious tradition, that is Christianity for many of you, for others of you, for the others, a few who raised your hands, it may be Buddhism or other traditions, where in your religious tradition do you find resources or seeds of hope in this time of crisis? Seeds of hope or moral capacity to move toward the way things ought to be. Do you understand that question? What if I were to say to you or to your community, what does your religion offer in this time? What might you suggest?
I mean, I think for me, one thing, it's like the language of lament.
Just did you, can you all hear up here?
No.
Speak a little bit more loudly, and maybe say your name.
I'm Lauren. The language of lament that Christianity just gives words to, I guess, is really helpful for me to, like Psalms and kind of some of the...
Yes. Beautiful. Think of it. The power of lament. Womanist ethicist, that is, woman-identified African-American ethicist Emily Towns, in a book called Breaking the Fine Ring of Death, either ends or begins with a profound sermon on the book of Joel. And she says that in the book of Joel, the people recovered after catastrophic societal chaos began to recover when they engaged in public lament. And indeed, Jewish tradition and Christianity grounded in it is rich with the language of lament. Go to, as you said, the lament psalms. Is it possible that the church is one place that public lament could be enabled? We can lament profoundly without going into despair because we have promises that go with that. So thank you. Yeah, services of lament. Maybe that's something the church has to offer. Yes?
I like the story of Jonah. Sometimes you just don't want to go to Nineveh. God is telling you, you've got to go and tell those people the one thing they don't want to hear. But they listen and they change.
So Jonah took great risks, did not want to go the path where he was called, and was not well prepared. How many of you feel well prepared to deal with the climate crisis? And how many of you really want to deal with the climate crisis? So beautiful, I hadn't thought of that. What a story, what a kind of trope to interact with. Talk with Jonah. Yes, and your name was?
Elaine.
Elaine, and your name is?
Kyle. I would say,
can you hear up there?
To heed the commands of Jesus to love your neighbor and the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor. Uh-huh. If these are the people who are most affected by uh-huh. our actions, how can we, I think you said this as the week has gone on, how can uh-huh. we love our neighbor if we're doing this to these people?
Uh-huh. Okay, just to sit with that or spend a year as a congregation grappling with that question. I won't say more in response to that right now. It's smack on, but I'm going to try to grapple, dig more into that in a few minutes, so I'll let that go. Yeah. Emily.
I think the power of community that our churches bring and uh-huh. the fact that we can be intertwined with other parts of the community could bring great change.
Wow. Okay. The reality of community that our churches bring and that we can be interfaced with that community. Has anyone read the book, The Great Derangement? The Great Derangement, you should read. It's by Amitav Ghosh, G-H-O-S-H. an Indian, highly recognized Indian literary figure, not a religious figure. And towards the end of that book, I think it's about page 159, he says that humankind is deranged to have gone on as we are, just moving towards destroying the conditions for life on Earth. We're deranged, and he attributes this to the arts, to men, and to the politics, and to everything. But then, towards the end, he says, one of his greatest hopes is in religion. And you go, what? This is not a religious figure at all. He says religion for that reason, for a number of reasons. But one of them is that religion already has community established. Yesterday we talked about how being community with others on other continents. So I talked about the tree planting bishop, and then the African earthkeeping churches that plant a tree with every celebration of the Eucharist. So to be in communication with Christians, if you're a Christian in India, who are grappling with this, or in Detroit, who are creating what? Working with secular society and creating hundreds, I think thousands, of urban gardens for local food. Beautiful. It may be that we can't have real moral, well, it's true, we can't have real moral power without community, because we're shaped by community. So lovely. So lament, the models of going where we don't want to go and are not prepared to go, community, other resources from religion, yes?
Really, the simple answer is Jesus.
Say more.
And he was definitely an advocate for Sabbath and Jubilee economics.
Oh.
And the fulfillment of the scripture all the way back to the first story in the Torah, mm-hmm. 7-day creation, and throughout the Hebrew scripture, he fulfilled all of that by having
Okay, and Sabbath and Jubilee economics include a rest for the land. Is that not right?
Mm-hmm.
A rest for the land, and part of the whole matrix of climate change has been vast exploitation of the land's capacity to produce no rest. And do you want to just give a summary of what you mean by Jubilee economics? I mean, quickly.
So all slaves are set free. So pay Walmart people with more than they're getting right now.
Okay.
It's equitable distribution of the land after 50 years.
Okay.
So everything goes back. Everybody has the same thing that they owned 50 years previously.
Okay.
I mean, equity is key to addressing climate change.
So there we go. Jesus promoting Sabbath and Jubilee economics, and that grounded in the Hebrew scriptures, which are part of, and we can talk more about that, deeply a part of Christian scriptures. Beautiful. Those are, yes?
I don't know the scripture well enough to cite particular parts of it, but throughout both Jewish and Christian traditions, there's a sense of recovering. So coming through the bad, through the evil, and developing something that's positive and that helps provide room for life. And you know, that seems to be core to me, and it gives me a sense of at least a little bit of optimism that we can get through this if we work together.
Okay, so that is a profound dimension, isn't it, of Christian faith, a sense of recovery from the depths of horrors, of bad, of death and destruction. Very, very, very key promise. To me, I think of that as the promise of resurrection. And to me, that is part of what resurrection means, that in the midst of death and destruction, be it personal, or be it societal, or be it ecological, that somehow the end of the story is life, and life profound, life abundant for all. There was a time when I was deeply, deeply in despair about many, many things, including our being wound up in systemic injustice or systemic evil, economic injustice, whereby a few people have so much and so many have so little. And as the Jesuit priest in San Salvador, John Sobrino, does anyone know his name? A leader of the community that was martyred by the military forces in Salvador. I took a group of people to meet with him. We were in his office. And he said, you know, the economic in El Salvador, poverty means death, and people are not poor by chance. They're poor because the systems that make you wealthy make them poor. Oh, so you live with that. So that systemic kind of entwinement had me in despair. And to your point up there, I realized I needed to talk with someone who knew about systemic injustice and that maintained hope. So I went to see actually a Lutheran pastor in Seattle. His name was John Nelson. He was one of the leaders of the resistance to the nuclear Trident submarines that were coming across Puget Sound. Yeah. And I said, in fact, he was on the boat. There were boats, little boats would go out to try to blockade symbolically the submarines. And this was some years ago in the Seattle area. John was on one of the little boats with his 80-year-old mother. So they're out there in the little boat, and the Coast Guard comes with the hoses to squirt the people off, and the 80-year-old mother jumps up and waves her American flag and says, "Not in my America, you won't." So he had grown up with the sense of having a public voice about what's going on. But John's, I said, "John, how do you have hope?" And he said to me, "Cindy, I know the end of the story." Mm-hmm. He did not mean he really knew how it was going to end. He knew that what you were saying, that somehow the promise is, regardless, that life in God, that life emerges from the worst. Are you with me on that? Mm-hmm. I've been told I shouldn't say that. I've been told I shouldn't say it because people might then think that they don't have to do anything. God will just handle it. And the God that we know through Jewish and Christian traditions, the Christianity is the only one I know well, and I'm quite involved with the synagogue. I'm becoming more and more knowing of Judaism. This God that is sought to be known through those traditions works through the creatures of earth, including humans. So you can't sit back and say, "Okay, I know the end of the story." You say, "Oh, yes, and God is using us to reach the end of the story."
And we're part of the story.
Yes, very good. Thank you. Yes.
Is it okay for me to share a hope that I have for a resource?
Yeah.
What I really...
No hope in this room.
What I am really, really longing for is a national... We need... You know, to effect the big change.
Yes.
I mean, we can all do our little piece, but to effect the big change, I just have this vision of all Christians throughout America coming together in a massive movement.
Okay.
Which I think could really tip the needle, where it's great to do your local stuff in your parish and have your dinners and help immigrants, and all of that is so necessary, but big, we need big.
Okay, and so that's vital, that we all, and this is what we talked about yesterday, always see what you or your group is involved with as how it can feed into and align with and support a huge national and global movement. So one small piece of that movement would be, as you said, the church. Not the only part. In theological language, we call that movement of the church eco-justice reformation. That 500 years ago, we were called to reformation, and now eco-justice reformation. But yes, and interestingly enough, many bodies within the church are coming toward that. I would refer you to a couple of websites. One of them is LutheransRestoringCreation.com. And there are multiple resources on there, including liturgical resources and various things, and political resources, all kinds. And another is GreenFaith.org, which is an interfaith umbrella that is helping with that movement. Okay, I'd like to suggest, I would like to suggest two and maybe three additional seeds of moral, spiritual power and hope within Christianities. And we'll see how the time goes on whether we do two or three. The first, I will, how many of you are familiar with the term a theology of the cross? Okay, I so wish we had more time. I'd like to ask you what it means to you. But I'm going to share with you, so I'm kind of a teacher, so in teaching I don't just yak at people, I try to have them evoke their own knowledge, but again, we're on some time limitations here. So let me argue or suggest to you that a theology of the cross claims with a kind of fierce conviction that in the depths of human brokenness, including brokenness by climate sin, which I would argue we are broken in climate sin, that in the depths of human brokenness, the saving Christ is present, is healing, is liberating. My mentor, Larry Rasmussen, said it this way, I quote, "The force that truly can heal creation is drawn instinctively to our brokenness, and there draws forth power that we did not know we had."
Oh, do that one again.
The force that truly can heal creation, and I would change that to a force that truly can heal creation, is drawn instinctively to our brokenness, and there draws forth power that we did not know we had. Now, of course, we could talk the rest of the time about that and what that means for our personal individual brokenness and our societal brokenness.
Cynthia?
Yes.
Is that quotation in Earth-Honoring Faith?
No. Okay. It's something he said someplace somewhere that I sorry, I wish
well,
I could.
Well, that scares me scrounging the book.
Yeah. A good resource, Earth Honoring Faith. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me tell you about another resource, Resisting Structural Evil, Love as Ecological Economic Vocation. And that's my book, one of my books, and I invite you to take a flyer. It was won a National Award for Social Justice Literature, so there you go. And Cornel West said this is a grand prophetic book motivated by love and focused on justice, social, so anyway. There you go. My Norwegian grandmothers would roll over in their graves at my taking a moment of self-promotion. They did not do that. Do you have Norwegian grandmothers?
Yeah.
Oh, this was the most beautiful meal. No, it wasn't very good. So there you go. That's my heritage. No, I love my grandmothers. A theology of the cross. I think it enables seeing the economic and ecological brutality of which we are a part and in which we are implicated, without being destroyed by that knowledge. Because we may trust that God's saving presence and love for us is there, regardless of the fact, if you dare to take it in, you know, that how we live that we thought was a good life is rendering this incredible destruction that is threatening the future for all, for our own kids. That's where it hurts the most. What's the world of my grandchildren and children to be? Taking that in, to me, it helps to know that God's loving, healing, saving presence is there despite that brokenness. I actually believe it to be vital for us to know that if we're going to dare to face who we are. There is, do you know the text, of course you know, the text in Genesis where God creates and says, it is good, it is good, it is good, the creation stories. That word good, a Hebrew Bible scholar when I was speaking once said, Cynthia, it doesn't mean just good. It means, the word is tov, Tov, depending upon how you do the Hebrew. T-O-V or T-O-B. It means a good that is life-furthering, life-generating. It makes sense, doesn't it? Because everything that happens in that story, the plants and the seeds and the animals, they all go out and generate more life. What we are doing is not endangering Earth. We're endangering Earth's life-generating capacity. So we're uncreating. That's a little bit scary to think. What does it mean to do the opposite of God's primal act? So I believe that to face that, it helps to believe, as the theology of the cross says, that in the worst of human brokenness, God is present and is loving and is forgiving. That truth was emblazed on my soul many, many, many years ago. My mother was actually murdered by three men in our home. And I won't go into all of that, of course. What I want to say about that is that I remember knowing that those men were beloved by God, just before and after that, beloved, which says to me, which tells me the truth of that. So you are beloved, despite the fact that you are part of this horrible period in human history and are a cause of it. Now, truth telling about climate change is vitally important. So I think a theology of the cross, God's saving, loving presence with us in our brokenness, despite being perpetrators of bad, is also vitally important to enable that kind of truth-telling. I also have been criticized for saying that. Not about my mother. And I didn't talk about my mother publicly for many, many years, for decades. But I do now because I want to make that point. But I've been criticized for emphasizing this love of God for us despite what we're doing, because people say that maybe it will keep people from acting. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
I don't believe that. I think it's dangerous. I think it's dangerous to make that claim about the unconditional love of God. But I think it's vital. And I don't think it suggests that we don't need to act, because, as we said a moment ago, this great mystery that Christian traditions and Muslim and Jewish traditions give the name of God, even though it's an inadequate name, works through humans. That's clear in biblical faith. That's one, not only through humans, as we reread the Bible from the perspective of the earth, God also works through the winds and the mountains and the trees. Okay, not only humans, but God works through the creatures of earth. So we're not off the hook. We're simply not off the hook by virtue of this claim. And God's rules for how humans are to live out God's ways are two. Love your neighbor as yourself. We've got it in Leviticus, and then we've got it repeated by Jesus. And the first command to the humans in the creation story, to serve and preserve, Abba and Shamar are the Hebrew words. And Shamar, the garden. So there we've got it, the rules for economic life. Serve the well-being of the neighbor, especially the vulnerable one, and take care of the earth. So those lead us to a second seed of hope and moral spiritual power. The first was a theology of the cross. The second is the mind-boggling gift and call to love neighbor as self. The amazing gift and call to love neighbor as self. According to why... Wait, there was a question back here.
Oh,
please.
I was just going to refer you to people who say, like, calling on saying that God loves us something when we're part of a broken system. Uh-huh. I don't think you can really have a theology of redemption if you don't think that God still loves you, because he who is forgiven much loves much. Uh-huh. So yes, uh-huh, we are part of the system, uh-huh, but that also calls us to do what we can to fix it because we have been forgiven. Uh-huh. So we also must like take a step of faith and like walk forward to solve the problem. I feel like that's the exact opposite of, you know, sitting back and being like, it's okay.
Yes. Beautiful, beautiful point. Very good. Very good theological point. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I mean, it just occurred to me, I'm an early childhood person, that it is the kids who are, babies who are most securely attached and know they are loved, they are able to look back to their parents or to a God like we are, and then move forward and take risks and learn. And if they're not, if they don't have that message, don't have that connection, they don't so well. So I like to think of it that way. It doesn't, because they're loved, doesn't mean like, oh, I'm not going to do anything. It means
very
I can
good
take
point.
Risks and I can move forward.
Very good point. Those who understand once one knows oneself to be loved, it's more possible to love and love well. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Thank you. It's almost like you're both planted here to move on to this calling, this gift of neighbor love. According to widespread Christian tradition, but not all Christian tradition, and remember Christianity, I don't no longer talk about Christianity, I talk about Christianities, plural. But one widespread belief is that this is our calling, this is our vocation, this is our reason for being, to love, to receive and trust God's love, and then to live it into the world. Not to win God's love, because that's a given, and not to think that we'll ever love perfectly, because we won't. I love Luther's language that we are God's rusty tools, because it speaks to the imperfectness. You know, my husband who's up there will tell you, you know, my love is imperfect, and all of our love is imperfect, including our love in the public sense. But we are called to neighbor love. It's simple enough to say, but what that wild word means is far less simple. 2 millennia of Christians, and the Hebrew people before them, have sought to understand in each time and place what it means to love your neighbor as yourself, Leviticus 19:18. What love is and what it means has been the great moral question pervading this tradition for these 2,000 years and then the 1,000 before it in the Hebrew tradition. Martin Luther King says, and I'll quote, "Our responsibility as Christians is to discover the meaning of this command, discover the meaning of it, and then seek passionately to live it out in our daily lives," end quote. So what then does it mean for us to take seriously that command in this crucial period of time in human history? It's an outrageous idea. Love in the biblical sense is an outrageous idea. And I say that the faint of heart beware. It is not what we read on a Hallmark card. I, in fact, teach my students to try to get the word love out of their mind when we're studying what it means, because there are so many assumptions that are so domesticating and truncating of what love means. It's often seen just interpersonally, like how I treat people I come in contact with. But love in the biblical sense is not just interpersonal. It is interpersonal, and it pertains to our public lives. Let me ask you, if you were a congregation seeking to spend a year on what it means to love neighbor, what might you need to ask?
Who is our neighbor?
Okay, who's our neighbor for one? That's a great starting question. In the biblical sense, neighbor love is, my neighbor is not just the person who I have in contact with, it's whomever my life touches. Okay, in the face of globalization, it includes the Walmart worker that was mentioned up here. In the face of climate change, it includes the climate refugee who's now been flooded out of his or her home. Due to climate-related storms, my neighbor is global. So what let me name 3 characteristics of neighbor love. 1, it serves the well-being of whomever is loved. 2, it's brilliantly constructed to presuppose the good of self-love. So all of you were taught not to love yourself, and I don't know, maybe you all are good at loving yourself, I'm not so good. Know that the biblical command affirms self-love, self-respect, self-honoring. Love your neighbor as yourself. But third, where systemic injustice causes suffering, seeking the well-being of those who suffer entails challenging that injustice. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Dietrich Bonhoeffer called this putting a spoke in the wheel of injustice. So that means in a racist society, challenging racism, challenging the white supremacist underpinnings of our society. In the face of climate change, it means challenging the systems that render climate change. It means justice making is not an optional part of loving neighbor. But if love includes justice making, things get more difficult, no?
Yeah.
Like controversial conflict? I've been saying we should start courses in our synods on dealing with conflict so that community, Christian communities, can be places where we face difficult conflictive issues like what to do about climate change and do that well. Well,
quick question, sorry, up here.
Yeah.
Can you repeat the first of the 3 points you just made?
The three features?
The three features of neighbor love.
Serving the well-being of?
Yeah, so that made me think, and especially what you're just saying about conflict really made me think about
it. Yes.
So our neighbors that are climate change deniers.
Yes.
How do we serve their well-being while... That's hard, right?
He was not planted up there. That's a beautiful question. And may I just say that it's a vital question? But if I start to go there in depth now, then we can't do something.
We're running out of time. Yeah, okay.
But I'm not running away from the question. I just don't want to put the time. I can't put the time right there right now. But it's vitally, it's vitally important because our congregations are full of people with different perspectives on this. And I would say the one clue to that for me has been to always assume faithful and good intent.
Right.
Like, don't assume that neighbor is somehow a shallow-minded idiot. Assume that neighbor is a faithful person seeking to do what's right and know what's right. And then what to me that helps in all things. And I think that is and find where we do agree. You probably agree with that neighbor in that you want an abundant life for your kids. And by abundant, I don't mean rich. I mean fullness of life. So thank you for that. Yeah. I would suggest that if neighbor love doesn't just mean helping the victims of climate change, but changing our lifestyles, public policies, and structures that create climate change, it means looking at economic life. It means looking at economic practices and policies. Neighbor love, historically, has a great deal to do with economic life. That reality became so clear to me as I was serving as a missionary in Honduras years ago, and my neighbors' babies were born malnourished. And they were malnourished not because their parents weren't poor because they were lazy. They were poor because the land was owned by foreign global corporations, including beef corporations, and all they needed was un pedacito de tierra, a little piece of land, and couldn't get it for those reasons. So that's an economic reality. Since then, I've encountered so many people from work in Africa and Asia and the U.S. who testify to the role of economic practices and policies in generating their poverty. It's important to note that for Jesus and for the prophets in whose footsteps he walked, and for many Christian theologians from the earliest days onward, and other Christian leaders, economic neighbor love challenged any economic practices. Neighbor love contradicted economic practices that exploit the poor. So that's been kind of a guiding thing. For Luther, that was vitally important. For Luther, the beginnings of what would later become capitalism were emerging. Luther taught that economic activity, that is buying and selling and investing, is intrinsically an act in relationship to neighbor, and thus had to be guided by what was good for the neighbor, especially the vulnerable neighbor, while meeting the needs of self. He was vehement and specific about that. He theologically denounced aspects of the emerging profit-maximizing economy that threatened the well-being of the neighbor. He taught that market practices that threatened the well-being of the vulnerable ought to be avoided if you were a Christian. If you weren't a Christian, no problem. But if you were a Christian, he established norms for economic life that prioritized meeting human needs over maximizing profit. And he was very specific. For example, this blew my mind when I first was reading it. It just totally, I had never learned this. I was way into adulthood before I learned this. When Christians may not buy essential commodities when the price is low and sell when it's high, for that doing that endangered the neighbors who then couldn't buy those commodities. Neighbors must refuse to maximize profit when buying and selling if it jeopardizes the poor. Whoa, what is that? How many of you have a money market or stocks? It's buy low, sell high. So Luther would roll over in his grave and say, if you're a Christian, no. Now I bring this up. And he taught that pastors, he admonished pastors, that they should, from the pulpit, So remember this next time someone says, don't deal with economics or politics from the pulpit. He said pastors should unmask hidden injustice from the pulpit, thus opening the eyes of secular authorities for their mandate to establish justice. End quote. Well, according to Luther, neighbor love had three parts. One was love manifest in serving the neighbor. Two was love manifest in denouncing exploitation. And third was love manifest in rejecting economic practices that exploited others. So what does this mean about climate change? Take a look at the physical reality. The economic order that we assume advanced global capitalism won't be going on long into the future. And I don't say that as a moral or political claim. I say it as a physical, biophysical, geophysical claim. That is because the form of economy that we have, advanced global capitalism, requires or presupposes, one, growth at almost any cost, understood as a good. Secondly, freedom to maximize profit, understood as a human right. So I can pay my Walmart worker not enough to keep a home over her or his head. It's my human right to maximize profit, including devastating environmental impacts, such as maximizing profit through the drilling of oil and gas and coal. Three, it requires a societal consumption orgy that is fueled by a brilliantly creative advertising industry. The global economy as we know it, I could read you documents, classified documents from 1943 that name the grand area of the world we must control economically to maximize our markets. So the third is the consumption orgy, and fourth is spreading that consumption orgy worldwide. Those four things Earth can't sustain. That's the physical reality. maximizing growth, maximizing profit, and maximizing consumption, Earth can't keep doing. So the economy will change. It won't keep making those rules. That's the physical reality. The spiritual and religious reality and moral reality is that human beings will determine how the economy changes. Human beings. So it's up to human beings, including, one could argue, Christian human beings, Jewish human beings, and Muslim, and at least Buddhist human beings. Those are the religions I know demand a kind of either compassion or neighbor love that serves the vulnerable. We can help determine where the economy goes. Does it go toward serving Earth's well-being and diminishing the gap between wealth and poor, or does it go the opposite direction? Are you with me on that? Mm-hmm. So I am just trying, I'm not trying to say that profit is bad or growth is bad. I'm saying that they need to be subservient to Earth's well-being and human well-being. I'm also not taking a stand against business. I'm taking a firm stand for business that has a triple bottom line. Not only a financial bottom line, but a financial, an ecological, and a social well-being bottom line. Business has an enormous role to play in bringing us to more carbon-neutral ways of living on this earth. I'm also not talking about impossible ideals, because, and this might be the most important thing I can say, economic systems are constructed by human actions and decisions. They're not inevitable. Anything constructed by human actions and decisions can be unconstructed and reconstructed by human actions and decisions. Do you hear me? So we're not talking about the inevitable. When we look at advanced global capitalism. Well, this is all to say that we are called to neighbor love. Neighbor love includes challenging systemic injustice, and in the age of climate change, that includes challenging the economic policies, practices, and principles that continue to produce climate change. Now, As a theological claim, this is accompanied by an astounding moral anthropology. And a moral anthropology is an understanding of who we are as human beings. And I would argue that Christianity, and I'm linking this to neighbor love, don't worry, I'm not going off track, that Christianity has a moral anthropology that is replete with power. I once was on a panel with a young undergraduate student. She said she had traversed the world's religions and come back to Christianity, and I said, why? She said, because it gave me an honest story of an honest moral anthropology, meaning a story of who we are. And I would argue to you that who we are, grounded in Christian traditions, this understanding is one, beloved, and I've talked about that. Two, broken by sin. But third, body of God's love. How paradoxical. Broken by sin and body of God's love. That is, there is a claim, an understanding that the profound force that can truly heal creation, the justice-seeking, earth-honoring love of God is given to live within us, is breathed into us. That is, we, I think, not as individuals, but as, yes, as individuals, but also as communions. Emily mentioned community, but as community, as communion, we are given the love of God that will not be defeated by anything. Back to Rick's raising the resurrection. God says God's love will not be defeated by anything. Lives within us. That love seeks justice. and relishes the earth. So, coming back to neighbor love, you are not only called to love neighbor as self, you are empowered by the gift of God's indwelling love to love neighbor as self. Go think. What an amazing gift and then thing to unravel for the rest of your life. As I was studying the meaning of neighbor love, the subtitle was Love as Ecological Economic Vocation, I learned something from a junior colleague of mine, a New Testament scholar. And you know, we can say, well, why is the Bible important? The Bible just keeps revealing these amazing things, like Sabbath economics that you brought up here, and the justice commitment of neighbor love. But the new, something else I learned from this junior colleague was that the word in you shall love your neighbor as yourself, agapao is the Greek. Nice blue, nice color. It is not just in the imperative. You know, the imperative is a command. Haven't you always thought of it as a command? How many of you thought of it as a command? I thought of it as a command. You will love your neighbor as yourself. Go out and love your neighbor. It's not just in the imperative. It's in the future indicative. Do you understand what that is? That means you will love your neighbor as yourself. It is a promise. So somehow we are given the promise that we will. In the midst of massive climate injustice, you will. Now, to me, that's mystery, because I don't know how that works, but it's also promise. And it is, I think, because we are given the love of God to dwell within us. That in, do you see what I'm saying? So it's not only an ethic of neighbor love, it's a spirituality and a promise of neighbor love. Many of you are back. Well, I don't have time to go. Well, I do. I have 3 minutes. many of you were baptized? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in Lutheran traditions, baptism, in the affirmation of baptism, like a confirmation, the pastor says, do you intend to continue in the covenant that God made with you in holy baptism? God made a covenant with you when you were a baby in holy baptism. And then it goes through 5 things. To live amongst God's faithful people, to da da da. The last one is to seek justice and peace in all the earth. So God made a covenant with you when you were a baby that you would seek justice and peace in all the earth. Well, that is one reason to that's one reason to rejoice. Back to Jonah. It's one reason to have fear and trembling. And then to rejoice. And it's also one reason to, in our churches, in our congregations, as formation, prepare people for seeking justice and peace in all the earth. Well, there were some other seeds of hope and moral spiritual power that we could probe had we had tons of time, but we're not going to do them because we're coming to the end of our time. I would like to... just say a couple of things in closing. And one of them is that at this testing point in human history, something new is asked of our species. And that is to forge ways of living that enable Earth's web of life to flourish, and all people to have the necessities for life with justice and joy. Where something new is asked of humankind, something new is asked of religion. And that is to plumb the depths of our traditions for the wisdom and the vision and the courage to contribute to that pan-human, interfaith, great work of forging sustainable and equitable ways of living. We have few years remaining to avoid the worst of climate catastrophe. We are called to drink deeply from the wells of our traditions, to discern where the Spirit of God is at work, and then to participate in that work, including the work toward climate justice. It is a grand gift, and it is a profound burden. So I thank God that we're not called to bear that burden alone. We're called to shoulder it together with one another, the gift of community that was noted upstairs moments ago. And we are called to engage that great work with communities of people, religious and not religious, worldwide. And we have the promise, the sure promise of God working with, God working with us, but no, I won't, of ourselves working with that great mystery we call God to bring forth ways of living that enable all to flourish. So I invite you in your worlds to go back to the work we did yesterday or last Wednesday of looking at the various elements, the levels of change and the forms of action for change, and also to engage in continually probing the gifts of the faith tradition to enable and support that great movement towards God's dream of life abundant for all. With that, I think I've successfully not gone more than 1 minute over, and I invite continued conversation as the days go on.
Thank you. Thank you.